This is the Education Gadfly Show.
So, dude, what's up with it?
What's up with what?
I don't know. That. Whatever that happens to be.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Joe Flacco of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
You know, Mike, I'm not sure whether I'd be flattered or whether I ought to feel dissed.
I know.
Because usually Flacco is seen as the weak link on the Ravens, but I got to say, last week, he outplayed Brady.
I know, but they lost nonetheless.
They being the Ravens.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So, I don't know. This could mean that, you're often the smartest guy in the room and making the best points, but that doesn't mean that people actually adopt your policy prescription.
Or you're saying I'm a loser.
Either one. You take your pick.
Well, so mostly, did you watch all the football last weekend?
No. I was babysitting. I got two little kids.
Yes, but your sons. You didn't have your two young sons watching the AFC and NFC championships?
We did watch the first couple of minutes of the second game while we were throwing a football around, and then it just wasn't working out. And so we had to transition. The other strange thing was, we
what did
have
you transition
allowed them.
To?
We played this game where there was a cardboard box and it was a canoe. It's a long story. Anyways, by the end, the cardboard box was torn to shreds. That was the game. It was pretty fun. So the other thing was, being a Whole Foods Republican, I don't allow my kids to watch commercial television. We'll watch stuff via Netflix, PBS shows and stuff, but no commercials. So it was strange to be watching the football games. You could tell that they were suddenly very curious about the commercials, which they've never really seen before.
Well, the other trick here.
Yeah.
It's like on the 3 o'clock game, mm-hmm. you start watching about 4:15 or 4:30, mm-hmm. and then you can just fast forward through the commercials.
Oh, if you have one of those fancy dancy
you don't have a DVR?
Things?
You have
no.
a DVR. Mike.
No, I don't have that.
It's like you live like in 1997.
I have cable for the first time in years. This is a huge accomplishment. The fact that I could turn on the game was pretty wild. All right, hey, lots to talk about. It's good having you back on the show, Rick. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We got Amber's Research Minute, and we have Chris's What's Up With That. Let's get started, Ty, and play Pardon the Gadfly.
With Newt's surge in South Carolina, the Republican race is scrambled again. From the perspective of federal education policy, does it matter? Would a President Romney or President Gingrich be all that different from one another on education issues? Would they be all that different from Barack Obama?
What's your take, Rick?
I'm not sure a Romney would be all that different from Obama. I think Gingrich, who knows what he would be because he would keep it on council. But I got to tell you, I find it incomprehensible that Gingrich actually wins the Republican nomination.
Wait. Wasn't he recently a colleague of yours at the American Enterprise Institute?
Yeah.
Are you going to just throw him under the bus, Rick? Where's your loyalty?
He's an interesting guy. I find it incomprehensible that he might actually win the Republican nomination. And if he were to, by some incomprehensible set of events, I think Obama would very likely be looking at winning 45-plus states in the fall.
I do agree. But we can't take political positions on this show. But as an analyst, I think your analysis is probably correct about the outcome. Let's talk about Romney, then. If he's the nominee, you say he's going to be broadly similar to Obama. The Republicans on Capitol Hill are very far to the right of where they were 10 years ago, mm-hmm. certainly far to the right of George W. Bush and Margaret Spellings. Do you think Romney is going to follow them that far to the right in terms of giving power back to the states?
I don't think Romney seems inclined. He doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's going to pick fights with the legislature. And so, if the center of gravity in the Republicans is where it is, mm-hmm. we see Klein introducing his pretty aggressive rollback of NCLB. I don't think Romney's going to fight them on it. But it does strike me also that Romney seems sympathetic to Race to the Top. He seems broadly sympathetic to the accountability framework of NCLB, even though I think clearly he wants to roll it back.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the roster of smart people he's got as in his ed team, these are people who are sympathetic, I think, to much of the Bush-Obama program in broad strokes.
Right. So I think there's going to be a real fight within the Republican Party on this issue because, there's quite a bit of distance now between a Klein and a Barack Obama on some of these key questions of accountability, mm-hmm. et cetera. So, I think probably the most likely outcome is that Romney triangulates on the education issue, that he does not go as far to the right as congressional Republicans, but he cannot be anywhere near the Margaret Spellings position unless he wants to be, have a huge ocean between him and the Republican members of Congress.
I think that's right. Right. But I think also, Margaret is still influential, obviously, and continues to be influential in Republican circles. And I think she and folks who share her point of view will push that aggressively. Yeah. And it will be interesting how Romney responds.
Okay. Topic number two.
Charles Murray had a big essay in the Wall Street Journal last Saturday, previewing his new book about the cultural divides that are cleaving America. He demonstrates that upper middle class whites and working class whites now live in very different worlds. Is education to blame? And can schools help to address this problem?
And it's not just that they live in different worlds, Rick, though there is some of that. I mean, when I wrote about Whole Foods Republicans, I was getting at some of this, right? The upper middle class, people can joke about shopping at Whole Foods and, buying their brie and et cetera, et cetera. But you have vastly different life outcomes on a number of important indicators. Probably the most important one is now around marriage, that the floor has just fallen out on marriage among white working class, that fewer people are getting married in the first place, a lot of out-of-wedlock births, and then a huge divorce rate. And that's looking very different than you have for upper middle class, better mm-hmm. educated whites. So, and the question is this about education? The people who've gotten more education are on the upper middle class side of this divide. And if you didn't, you're basically screwed on various measures.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because you can tell two diametrically opposed narratives about this, right? The Obama narrative is that in order to make sure that working class people get a chance to get ahead, that we have to make sure they have opportunities to access education, ongoing, lifelong learning. And that's one way to read kind of this schism. The other way to read it, and what Charles, I think at least suggests is reasonable, is that it's a difference of delayed gratification, that these upper and middle class families are raising kids who are disciplined, who put off, who if they have sex are careful about it, who are much more moderate in their drinking and drug use, who go to college, who complete college, who get jobs. And sure, these are advantages that they're obviously enjoying, but it's also that they're engaging in behaviors, which then lead to positive life outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that then passes on to their kids, because their kids are had by stable, affluent parents who then raise them in comfortable, stable environments. Mm-hmm. So part of this, when we have these debates about, about closing achievement gap, about the opportunity society, is what happens if people in the working class are choosing to do things which make it unlikely that they or their children are ultimately going to get ahead.
Yeah. And to the degree that there is a role for schools, and maybe there's not, but it's to say, are there some of these things we're not teaching in schools anymore that we should be, to put more of this focus on some of these soft skills? I mean, attributes, habits, so things like grit and determination and delayed gratification.
This gets us back to David Whitman's book that you guys published a couple of years ago, right? The Sweating the Small Stuff schools are very explicitly doing this. They are fighting mm-hmm. against norms in these families in these neighborhoods.
Right. But those schools are by and large set up for poor, mostly black and Hispanic
That's
children.
Right.
So the question is, what about, the typical white working class kid goes to sort of your typical big American high school and, that you might see on Friday Night Lights, and they...
And we don't want to judge.
Right.
And we don't want to make kids feel shamed
right.
about... inappropriate behaviors.
Well, and there's the Horace's Compromise thing, that these kids are in schools that are not asking too much of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying, hey, as long as you don't, misbehave and cause trouble for me, I'm not going to push you too much. I was talking to a friend about this the other day who has one daughter who went through the honors track at her suburban high school and got pushed and, really mm-hmm. rigorous stuff. And his other daughter now is in high school and is in the non-honors track. And it's just a world difference. And there's just no rigor. She comes home without homework almost all the time. And this isn't a well-regarded public high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, okay, kids that are not getting pushed like that, and the parents say, okay, that's fine, everybody's going along, get along. You just say, wow, I mean, this is, are we doing enough in our school system to, push kids who, for whatever reason, are not getting pushed enough at home?
I think that's right. But I think, I haven't read the entirety of Charles's manuscript, but just one key thing is, in some ways, that makes it too easy on us, because we can say, oh, we're for IB, we're for AP, we're going to run rigorous programs. Charles's point, I think, is that stuff's good, but that what really matters is, are you going to put off getting married?
Mm-hmm.
Are you careful not to have kids out of wedlock?
Yeah.
And frankly, we've got lots of people who go through good programs and then are engaging in these kinds of behaviors.
Yeah.
And in fact, in some sense, by healthcare reform, by allowing kids to stay on their parents' insurance up to 26, is actually encouraging or supporting these.
Yeah.
out of our sense of open-mindedness.
We need more shame. That's what you're saying. Or at least what Charles is saying. Okay, topic number three.
As Jay Matthews reported, a Virginia legislator and parent wants to pass a law requiring public schools to allow parents to observe their kids' class, with reasonable advance notice and minimal disruption. Has this helicopter parenting gone awry, or a reasonable response to bureaucracies that are insensitive to parents' needs and concerns?
Look, I think this is reasonable. You know, those of you that listen to the show, you know, I've got a four-year-old. He's in a Waldorf preschool right now, which is a whole other set of fun things to discuss. It's a preschool that's a part of a larger preschool to K to 12 Waldorf school. So suddenly, I didn't really plan on this, but I'm a private school parent, at least for right now. Mm-hmm. He'll be going to public school because we can't afford the whole shebang. But, you know, and one of the things that they do at this school is make it very clear that parents are welcome to come in and see what's going on in school. Now, they don't say, hey, drop by whenever you want. They try to set up certain days and certain, you know, when they are expecting to have visitors. And they want you to schedule in advance because they don't, you know, to have more than a couple of parents there at any one time would be disruptive. But they make it possible for parents to come in and just see what it looks like and what's going on. To me, that's just I can't believe that. Wouldn't any school want to have that? And wouldn't they want to have their parents coming in and taking a look? And you want to organize
now,
it
organized?
Why not?
Are parents allowed to raise questions from the sideline during class? Or are they allowed to push back on the teacher?
I don't know. I would suspect no, that the answer is, you know, you're there to observe. And then if you wanted to raise issues with the teacher after the fact, there's lots of ways to communicate.
But I guess
you're not there as you're not on the sidelines in a football game right. Shouting out your.
But I guess I wonder, because it strikes me that Nico's Waldorf program is probably not a randomly drawn set of parents.
Right,
and
right.
I suspect you guys are all pretty good about obeying the rules right. And about being courteous about heads up. And I guess I think back to, East Baton Rouge Parish or Boston, and a lot of the parents that I dealt with, I just wonder how, whether or not parents would be eager about following all of the expectations and rules. And if not, what are teachers supposed to do?
So what are you saying? The parents were crazy? They were on crack?
I think some parents are responsible. Some parents, this is how they feel like their child is the most important thing in their life. And by God, who's going to write these rules that if parents are allowed to go into the classroom, how come they're not allowed to go when they want to go? Mm-hmm. And if they see something that's being done that they don't like, why should they have to sit there and watch the teacher do a bad job? Mm-hmm. And I could just imagine as a teacher, all you need is a couple of these out of 150 if you're a high school teacher.
Right.
And your job just became exponentially more difficult.
So what was the policy in East Baton Rouge?
So the parents weren't in the classroom, but just dealing with parents, just calling home.
But was there a policy that said if you wanted to come into the classroom,
I have no idea. It never happened while I was teaching down there.
Yeah.
I'm just totally torn on
this. It seems like even if there was a policy, the point is most parents won't take advantage of it.
That's right.
I mean, now maybe it's a high school, elementary school thing. Maybe, we know a lot of parents kind of check out once their kids are in high school, and their kids would probably be mortified to have them sitting there in the class. Mm-hmm. Might be different for elementary schools. You know, Ty looks a little hesitant on this fact, too. Ty was a Teach for America teacher in Camden, New Jersey. Same thing. You worry that some of those parents are just would create a scene?
Well, I wonder if the ones who take advantage of it are the ones who maybe are going to be the least likely to follow the expectations that are laid out. On the other hand, the students who would benefit most from having their parents in class are probably ones with minimal parental involvement. So I think that maybe if there are case-by-case situations where parents are invited to classrooms, that could be helpful. And I did that. I invited parents. But making it a norm where any parent with reasonable notification could attend could invite some very tricky situations, as Rick said.
That said, I'm sympathetic. I think what you sketch out, I think all of us are like, wait a minute. These schools are taking your kid away from you 6-7 hours a day, half the year. What kind of bureaucracy says, no, you can't go see what's being done with your child?
Right.
So I'm totally sympathetic. I just think I find myself torn on this one. It's a really interesting question.
I think we should do an experiment. Let's randomly assign schools to this policy and see what happens. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Amber, what did you spend your morning doing today?
Commuting. That would be 2-hour and 15-minute commute. I know. Getting really bad.
This was on the red line. Somehow I missed this problem just by a few minutes.
You pick it up at a different place, I think, than I do too. So I get the backup all the way down. Yeah. You know?
A cracked line on the metro. That's something you don't want to hear every day.
No, I know. I kind of wish they hadn't announced that's what the problem was.
Yeah. All right. Anyway. But you know it's not broken. The research minute.
Ee-hoo, I like that segue.
Awesome. What do we got this week?
This week we got the latest installment of NCTQ's State Teacher Policy Yearbook. So analysts examine state teacher policy in 5 areas: delivering well-prepared teachers, expanding the pool of teachers, identifying and retaining effective teachers, and exiting ineffective teachers. So in short, they found that 28 states have improved their grades since 2009. That's kind of a big deal. They also awarded their highest teacher quality grades ever to 7 states, one of which received the highest overall grade of B. Mike, who do you think it is?
I think that's going to be
Indiana.
Florida. But Indiana made it in there.
Hold on a second. Can you say that one more time? I muted your...
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
It's going to be Indiana.
It's Florida. Anyway, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and Tennessee also scored high with B minuses. And Indiana, yes. Michigan and Ohio garnered C pluses. Not too shabby. However, Alaska, California, Missouri, Mississippi, and Montana made absolutely no progress on their teacher policies since 2009. Biggest progress across the nation in teacher policy has been the move to include student achievement as part of teacher evaluations, which we can kind of see that coming. 24 states now do that. In 2009, no state awarded tenure based primarily on teacher effectiveness. Now 8 states do that. And 11 states now require districts to consider teacher performance, not just seniority and teacher layoffs. I actually thought that number would be a little higher. Two big areas of weakness. My last point here, states do very little to ensure teacher quality into the profession. In other words, licensure tests are still horrendous. And the financial health of teacher pension systems continues to decline.
Lovely. Now, you know, a couple of things to clarify here. This question about seniority versus performance. I understand that these laws, first of all, there's a law that could say you must do LIFO. You must do last in, first out, right? And my understanding is that several states got rid of those laws, right? Then there could be, then the state could be kind of silent on how you do it. And then there could be states saying you must look
at student
performance.
That's exactly
And we've seen
works.
Progress in all of that.
That's right.
Okay. Now, Florida gets this high
Florida
grade,
high
you know, and which, you know, they have done a lot on teacher quality and on teacher effectiveness, and they have this now, basically they've gotten rid of tenure for new teachers, so that's probably a big part of this, right? But this teacher evaluation system that they have in Florida has taken a lot of flack for being pretty top-down and perhaps not as nuanced as it needs to be. I guess that doesn't factor into the grades.
Yeah, I don't think they actually looked at the evaluation system itself. I think it's just like a higher grade. Does it count, you know, in this way? But yeah. I mean, I think that'd be obviously useful information to have, but it's not at the grain size that these studies tend to be.
Yeah. You know, people may look at this and say, well, this is probably because of race to the top, right? Mm. The administration made a big focus on these teacher effectiveness issues, and that we've got states replying. But when you start to break down some of the data, what you find is actually most of the movements was in 2011, after the race to the top, at least the main race, was over. And is on some of these issues like LIFO that race to the top didn't even touch.
So you thought it gave it some momentum? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's one question. I think that, look, I think race to the top deserves some credit, but my point was going to be, mostly what deserves credit is that Republicans sweeping into office and because the 2010 elections created the political dynamics where you could do a lot of these things. That at the end of the day, having Republican-controlled legislators and governors willing to go, you know, take out LIFO, take on tenure, I mean, that seems to be the big thing that's happening here.
Yeah.
A place like Oklahoma where they've got this new state superintendent and a very heavily Republican legislature, and they really came through and pushed some very aggressive policies.
Pinette was big on this, right? I mean, those. I mean, I feel like, you know, the interactions I had with Pinette, they were all talking LIFO, you know, in the last couple of years. So they kind of made it their big agenda item as well. So.
All right. So, Amber, now it's time for Pop Quiz.
Pop Quiz. So last week we asked what percentage of first-year undergraduate students took remedial courses in 2007-08. The answer was 36%, which 40% of our viewers, our listeners, we don't have viewers yet, do we, got right. So that's pretty good. And 40% said 27, so they were kind of split. But anyway, big chunk of our folks got the answer right. This week's poll question, drum roll. We need a drum roll. What percentage of teachers under the age of 30 left the profession of teaching after the 08-09 school year? So we want to know how many young teachers left. They didn't move. They left. They said sayonara completely. So would that
for
be...
For that 1 year. I see.
Right.
At the end of the school year, they said, 08-09 school year. I'm done.
I'm done.
Yeah.
So that would that be 6%, 8%, 11%, or 13% are our options?
I will be pondering it.
So our listeners need to go to edexcellence.net/podcast to cast their vote.
Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes, sir.
Hello, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Mike.
So, dude, what's up with that?
What's up with what?
I don't know. That. Whatever that happens to be.
Well, don't look now, but the government is wasting even more of your time and tax dollars debating issues clearly beneath their pay grade. Well, that is if you're a resident of Rhode Island, at least. Representative Peter Petrarca, a Democratic member of the House representing the areas of Lincoln, Johnston, and Smithfield, has introduced legislation that would create a statewide policy banning text messaging during school hours. What's up with that? Citing the fact that too many students spend class time text messaging, Petrarca is calling on the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education to establish a statewide policy against it. Talk about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Most schools already have a policy against texting during class. Does he really think taking this fight to a higher level is going to be any more effective? I must have forgot to read the news the day when Rhode Island passed the law allowing their publicly elected officials to be out of touch with reality. Petrarca says the policy would allow texting in the case of health or safety emergencies or for educational purpose. How in the hell does he expect to monitor that? And where do you draw the line on what qualifies as a, quote, health or safety emergency? This bill is full of more holes than a Newt Gingrich argument for morality. The bill is scheduled to be heard by the General Assembly on January 25th. For your own sake, Rhode Island, I hope to God you don't spend more than 5 minutes on this thing. All five of which should be devoted to talking about how much of an ignoramus Peter Petrarca and the co-authors of this bill are.
Well, you know, it would be easier to get more fired up about this if this kind of thing didn't happen every day of the week, at least 10 different times in different states. I mean, this is what legislators do. They get to the state legislature, they want to do something about education, and they write stupid bills like this.
Mm-hmm. I got to say, I mean, kids... And it wasn't entirely clear. Was he trying to outlaw all texting in the state of Rhode Island from like 8 to 3 or just for kids?
Just for kids.
So okay, that makes more sense.
At first, I thought it was some sort of thing where he'd be working with the tech companies to like literally shut texting down in the state during those hours. And then I realized it was just.
And I got to say, that would probably be great for productivity. Just nationally.
In general.
Absolutely. Especially if we did a rolling blackout through the time zones, kind of 8 to 3 every day.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're a classroom educator today and you got to deal with, you know, trying to keep these little, you know, punks kind of on task while they're busy kind of texting each other about, like, you know, where they're going to go chill after school, man. Anything you can do to get those damn phones out of their hands is worth doing.
I'm telling you, the Waldorf approach is looking better and better, Rick. I mean, Waldorf's all about no technology, no screen time. I mean, the idea is that the kids will never even know what they're missing because we keep them, you know, just part of an 18th century environment.
Nico has to leave his iPhone at home?
Of course, he doesn't have an iPhone.
So, Waldorf with four-year-olds, this is a very easy strategy to protect free.
All right. Well, they try it with the older kids. You know, what is interesting is the only thing that happened this week was Jerry Brown gave a big State of the State address in California. He talked about education, and, you know, mostly he was lauded by the Diane Ravitches of the world for saying things that sounded fairly critical of standardized testing. But mostly what he said was, hey, we have got to stop putting all these mandates on local school districts and local teachers from the state level, which I think actually makes a ton of sense, particularly in a place like California that has a habit of doing these sorts of things.
Yes.
So to Governor Brown, I salute you. to legislator
Petrarca.
Petrarca.
That's
my paisante.
Disturbing. Disturbingly similar name. But
go focus on something you could actually do something about.
Seriously.
What's up with that? That's all the time we got for this week. Thanks everyone for joining us. Remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast or hated it, head to edexcellence.net/podcast to find links and more about this episode and to see our vast archives. Almost 6 years of podcasting.
Wow.
Rick. And what has that gotten us?
Wow.
Still waiting for the movie deal. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.